and former CIA analyst is joining us from Raleigh, North Carolina. Also with us is George Samueli, senior research fellow with Global Policy Institute, London Metropolitan University, out of Budapest.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Let's begin with Ray. According to this U.S. intelligence report, Tel Aviv seems adamant to want to destroy Hamas, that, of course, enjoys great public support in Gaza. It predicts that the Israeli regime could face a lingering armed resistance from Hamas for years. I'm quoting it directly. So, and as you see, they're already running short of their soldiers. They have to pass this legislation the other day to recruit ultra-Orthodox Jews who've always enjoyed exemptions from, you know, doing military service. Let's have your take on that.
You said Tel Aviv, in speaking of the Israeli government. This assessment, unfortunately, says Jerusalem. Things have changed. The CIA used to be a lot more objective. Let me start with the good news. The good news is that there was no Middle East section to the annual threat assessment last year. Jacob Sullivan, the national security advisor, who pretty much is a very smart guy, knew what was going to happen, and so he had a 7,000-word essay in foreign affairs, and it concluded 5 days before the October 7 attacks. Mm-hmm. The Middle East, I quote, "The Middle East is quieter than it has been in decades. Mm-hmm. Serious frictions have decreased, and we have, quote, de-escalated crises in Gaza," end quote. So this is small praise, but at least they have a section on Gaza, and atypically, they have a section on Israel. Now, what does that section amount to? Not much at all. We have a fifth-grade son who is exposed to 10 minutes of CNN every morning at elementary school. CNN, 10 minutes for grade schoolers, I could have written, and it sounds very much like what was written here. The main issues are not addressed, and when they are mentioned, the fact that Netanyahu may be in trouble and that a more moderate government might come in, well, that's not very helpful. You can glean that from any newspaper. So, again, I'm not surprised, but I am disappointed, except for a couple of things which are more positive, and I can mention those later.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, George, this report, what's interesting is that they're kind of actually alluding to the military and combat readiness of the Hamas movement, and that this will going to take a long time for Israel. And also some other aspects which we'll also discuss at a later time. Let's have your perspective of this.
Well, I agree with Ray that there's really very little that's new here, or very little that's surprising. The one thing that I found, maybe surprising isn't quite the word, but that the CIA evidently doesn't believe that there's much likelihood of a war between Israel and Iran. You would have thought that they want to maybe hype up the possibility of a confrontation. They're always warning about the dire threat posed by Iran. But here they kind of minimize this. They say that no, Israel and Iran are unlikely to reach a military confrontation. And indeed, the report then also says it's unlikely that Israel and Hezbollah will lead to a greater confrontation than just simply skirmishes across the border. So I thought that was quite surprising that it, you would say that's a reasonably optimistic assessment. However, overall, one could say that this war is likely to go on for quite some time, and I think the threat assessment does confirm that there is not likely to be any resolution or any prospect of something a workable framework developing anytime soon.
Okay. Now, Ray, another aspect, the media coverage of the destruction and loss of life the report says being amplified by social media is roiling public reactions by both neighboring countries and other countries elsewhere in the world. An instance is just we had Netherlands the other day, Vienna rally, for instance, and many other places, even inside the United States. Now, do you agree that Israel has gained hatred and indignation of the people of many countries by what it's doing in Gaza?
Well, it has, of course. And this is, again, a symptom of playing down controversial issues. It's not very revealing that social media are playing a major role in this conflict. Mm-hmm. I would add one thing that George and I have not yet mentioned. There are two rather positive things here. One is the reiteration that Iran had nothing to do with the October 7 attacks. As a matter of fact, it goes further and it says Iran didn't know
had no knowledge about
the October 7 attacks. So that was big. The other thing, and this is not negligible when you're talking about Iran, Israel. Israel, of course, always says that Iran is working on a nuclear weapon. The U.S. intelligence community, to its credit, for the 17th straight year, says, let me read this so I don't paraphrase it, quote, Iran is not currently undertaking the key nuclear weapons development activities necessary to produce a testable nuclear device. That's big. The U.S. intelligence community has resisted all kinds of pressure, not only from the likes of Netanyahu, but from the likes of the neoconservatives in the United States, to change that reading. It was in 2007 that an honest estimate was done on that. The fact that it's reiterated here is more than just looking for something favorable. This is significant, and the fact that the rest of it is pretty much pedestrian, well, this included is a positive sign.
All right, George, the report also warns that the conflict in Gaza highlights the potential for a spillover into a larger and more dangerous conflict. This is what Tehran has warned on multiple occasions. What's your assessment?
Well, it does say that, but as I said, it draws a line on the possibility, which is clearly the one that everyone's sort of afraid of, which is that there could be a war between Israel and Iran, which would, of course, drag the United States into it. But the report rather minimizes that. It really doesn't think that either Israel or Iran wants to get into a military confrontation. It does talk about Iran's proxies and possibility of increased skirmishes between Israel and these proxies, but it doesn't really go where you would expect a threat assessment to go, which is that, well, there could be a massive war in the Middle East. It doesn't seem to say that, and above all, where you might have been thinking, well, what about Hezbollah? Because that's obviously the big enchilada. There, somehow, again, they say, well, you know, Hezbollah is very wary of Israel, knows that it'll lead to the destruction of Lebanon. Hezbollah is unlikely to want a major confrontation with Israel. So it's not that pessimistic as far as the wider war goes. It's quite pessimistic about Gaza, however.
Now, Ray, what's your opinion about this spillover? How likely is that, and what could the repercussions be in that case?
Well, the likelihood of spillover is very, very great. The fact that it sort of dusted off just testifies to the prosaic aspect of this briefing. That is the big question. Whether Israel will attack Lebanon as it said it would? What's missing here, in a word, is any realistic appraisal of the situation, because the United States of America is a key player here.
Okay? Right.
And what you get here is not the question that is really to be posed, and that is, what would it take Netanyahu to stop the genocide? How much U.S. pressure would that take? Would it take just a telephone call? My view is yes, that's all it would take. And that would end all this business about Hezbollah coming in. So you have, instead of this addressing the key question, you have things pitched at the, as I said before, the fifth grade elementary school level, which I suppose is appropriate for most Congress people, I regret to say. But it's a kind of a briefing for them. You know, this is the state of the world, and this is where it looks. It doesn't really help the president or the Congress to say, well, how do we stop this thing before it evolves out of control? Hamas, Hezbollah, Iran are trying to control it. It's Israel that's the main problem, and we have a hold over Israel because we are enabling the genocide with our weapons and with our political support, our vetoes at the Security Council, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. All we have to do is change our policy. And of course, intelligence people have to pretty much shy away from that, because to be too blunt on that is to expose yourself to charges of politicization and worse.
Okay. Now, George, let's now turn to a number of Arab states in the midst of this. And this Gaza war is said to be posing a challenge to many of them. You know, on the streets, people are expressing their views. They are standing by Palestinians. They condemn Israeli crimes. But to Arab states, the authorities do not necessarily share the same views. And some of them, even, you know, they already signed the so-called deal of the century to normalize relations. And some of them, of course, regret it at this point. But you see that a number of them are just sitting there doing nothing, or maximum what they're doing is simply giving lip service and condemning every now and then.
Well, that's right. It's very unfortunate that a number of the Arab states are mostly concerned with how can they make more money. And they're thinking of those, well, we can make deals involving Israel. So we have the plan that the United States has signed on to as a kind of alternative to China's Belt and Road Initiative, which will involve a kind of a big infrastructure project, you know, going from India and then through the Gulf states and into Israel and then on to, into the Mediterranean and then on to Greece. This is the way they're thinking. They think, well, hey, this is fantastic. You know, we can make a lot of money. And this is obviously also the way Netanyahu is thinking. If you recall, when Netanyahu was stood before the UN General Assembly last September, basically just a few days before the 7th of October, and he pointed to a map of the new Middle East in which there was no room for Palestine, that's what he was thinking about. He was thinking about, hey, this is fantastic. We're going to have this great infrastructure project, you know, linking Israel to the wealthy Gulf states and into the Mediterranean. No room there for Palestinians. But unfortunately, and this is why Netanyahu thought, hey, I don't have to worry about the Palestinians, he has the support of these Arab states who are all looking to make some money out of all of this.
Mm-hmm. Now, Ray, another aspect mentioned in this report has to do with the resistance front, with Hezbollah in Lebanon, Iraqi resistance, and also the Yemenis that are operating in the Red Sea and Arabian Sea, targeting Israel-linked ships, and recently U.S. and U.K. Ships. And this report foresees that those operations by these three fronts will be going on. So right. Do you also agree with the same prediction?
Yeah, I do. And, you know, it's interesting that they always use the term resistance.
Mm-hmm.
Well, resistance to what? Like maybe genocide? Like maybe oppression for 70 years? So that's the resistance. And unless the causes of the resistance are addressed, there will be resistance forever. One puzzling part of this thing, or one complicating part, is that the head of the CIA is a member of the cabinet making decisions and also trying to negotiate the exchange of hostages and so forth. That is really, really noxious, because nobody can take seriously an intelligence officer who is also implementing and forming policy. So this kind of document, under the hand of William Burns and his nominal supervisor, April Haynes, really is hostage to what the director of the CIA is actually doing operationally as well, and ipso facto cannot be viewed as a totally objective briefing from intelligence.
Okay. Now, George, this U.S. intelligence report also argues that the distrust of Netanyahu's ability, I'm quoting, distrust of Netanyahu's ability to rule has deepened and broadened across the public from its already high levels before the war, and that they expect large protests demanding his resignation and new elections. A different, more moderate government is a possibility. Well, this is the U.S. intelligence assessment. What's yours?
Well, it's very interesting, because, of course, that is the view of the U.S. government, which has always found Netanyahu a little bit of an embarrassment, just as it has always found Likud a bit of an embarrassment, even going back to the days of Menachem Begin. One shouldn't take any of that too seriously. The United States is obviously more comfortable with the so-called liberals of Israel, who really don't disagree with Netanyahu very much on the issue of Palestine. They don't disagree with his policies in West Bank or in Gaza. They do disagree on other issues, which are basically about internal Israeli politics. It's not really important. But somehow, American liberals feel more comfortable embracing people they deem to be Israeli liberals, even though these Israeli liberals actually, like, Gantz, who's a member of Netanyahu's government, even though they pursue exactly the same policies. So, but they think, okay, well, at least those policies will have the same policies, but we'll have nicer people running it. So I don't take that terribly seriously.
Right. Yeah, Ray, how do you look at it? Does the U.S. really want what they call more moderate government?
The U.S. is fixated on the United States presidential election right now. Biden and his rival need money. The Israel lobby has the money. That's what they're fixated on now. Mm-hmm. As for the Israelis, you know, in 2001, when Netanyahu thought he was off the microphone, he said, and I quote, "I know the Americans, they're easily moved in the right direction. Would you believe it? 80% of the Americans support us no matter what we do. That's absurd." End quote. Now, it's no longer 80%, maybe 50%, but it's still an appreciable majority because of our press and because of the Congress people who need the money, of which George spoke before. So that's what the U.S. faces in terms of its political structure. Netanyahu is riding high. He's very vulnerable. But until the war ends, he's the guy you have to deal with.
Mm-hmm. George, if the U.S. really doesn't want somebody like Netanyahu, why does it keep supporting his regime, saying stop the killing, protect civilians and all that jazz? But on the ground, you see it's U.S.-made weapons taking the lives of civilians.
Of course it is. That's why all this talk about how they don't like Netanyahu, that Biden's patience is running thin, that they're supposedly putting pressure on Netanyahu behind the scenes, all of that is just a lot of nonsense. The Biden administration has a problem, as I alluded to by Ray. There's an election coming up. He saw what happened in Michigan, and he is clearly very worried that many people, particularly Muslim Americans, Arab Americans, are not going to vote for him. And so he has to put on this this front that somehow he's terribly, terribly unhappy with what Israel is doing, when if it was true that he was unhappy with what Israel was doing, he could bring it to an end. I mean, you know, it's it wouldn't be hard. I mean, you know, it really would take a phone call to say, that's it, we're cutting you off, you're not getting another penny from us. He's not going to do it. So therefore, his only resort is to leak things to the New York Times or the Washington Post to tell them how very unhappy he is, and then he's really getting very tired of Netanyahu. And Netanyahu contemptuously said the other day, apropos of Biden's red line about going into Rafah, right, and he said, hey, you know what my red line is? No more October the 7th attacks. So, you know, Netanyahu rightly treats the U.S. administrations with disdain.
Right. Now, Ray, what do you see on the horizon? Where will all of this end up in?
Well, let me try to put some threads together here.
Sure.
We have the Palestinian people, huge populations in Jordan, in Lebanon, even in Saudi Arabia, in Egypt. When will the rulers of those countries give appropriate heed to their wishes? Well, they aren't doing it yet. But let's say Biden's non-existent red line, which he said to MSNBC, they asked him, red line, well, yeah, it's a red line, but not a red line. And, you know, if 30,000 more Palestinians are killed, my God, that's no red line. So there is there no limit to the patience of these cowardly Arab countries and Turkey that talk a big game but don't do anything? Mm-hmm. I don't know. But Hezbollah is not going to wait forever. And if the Israelis hit Hezbollah, there will be a war on the northern front as well. Israel will not be able to continue at its genocide in Gaza much longer, in my view.
Okay, on that note, we come to the end of this show. Thank you, my guests, Ray McGovern in Raleigh, North Carolina, George Zamorli in Budapest. And thank you for watching this edition of The Spotlight.
This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, the invitation of Ramadan. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. It's an honor to be here at your service. Dear friends, we are talking about the holy month of Ramadan and how it is an invitation for every single one of us. Now, you know, again, one of the things that we have a tendency to do is not fully understand some of the practices that we do as a Muslim, or we don't understand some of the actions that we do, some of the commandments of the Almighty Allah, or perhaps we don't understand some of the ideological, theological, or jurisprudential, perhaps philosophical aspects of Islam. Now, that does not mean that Islam itself has some kind of a flaw or deficiency. In reality, it means that we are deficient and we don't have the appropriate amount of knowledge to be able to understand these things. Otherwise, these things are all based upon pure knowledge and wisdom. So, you know, one of the things that we don't understand, again, is the holy month of Ramadan. 29, 30 days, depending upon the sighting of the moon, you know, we are fasting from the time of Fajr until the time of Maghrib. You know, we kind of just leave it at that. We don't really bother to kind of delve a little deeper, get some more insight on to what exactly is going on in the holy month of Ramadan. And so when we are talking about the holy month of Ramadan, first and foremost, we need to understand that we are a guest. We are being invited to this great divine feast. And who is the one who is inviting us to this great divine feast? Well, it is Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the creator of the universe, the ultimate supreme master and king, and the one who is in control of the cosmos and the universe and life and death. Such an entity is inviting us to be his guest in the holy month of Ramadan.
Ramadan al-mustabin jaa bin nur al-mubin. Ramadan, Ramadan, Ramadan al-qanitin.
Welcome back. This is A to Z on IRIB English Radio. So, dear friends, we're talking about how we are invited in the holy month of Ramadan as the guests of the Almighty Allah. So, you know, what we're trying to do, of course, in order to, you know, understand this Islamic lifestyle, because fasting and the holy month of Ramadan is an integral and pivotal and central aspect in our Islamic lifestyle. And you know, this holy month of Ramadan, alhamdulillah, it comes every single year, and we have the opportunity every single year to be able to witness the holy month of Ramadan, to fast in the holy month of Ramadan, to worship in the holy month of Ramadan, and to gain nearness in the holy month of Ramadan. So we were saying in the previous segment, of course, that we are the guests of the Almighty Allah, and that it is the Almighty Allah who has put forth this beautiful invitation to the Muslims and to all of humanity, really, if humanity had the awareness to be able to take benefit and take advantage of these blessings. The Almighty Allah is not at all stingy when it comes to rewarding human beings for their good actions, whether Muslims or non-Muslims. Of course, a Muslim has a much higher level of understanding, and in return, they have a much higher level of reward. But still, what we're saying is that Allah will reward everybody their due reward based upon compassion and mercy and justice and knowledge and wisdom. And so we are being invited in this holy month of Ramadan to this great feast. Our perception needs to be along these lines. We need to view the holy month of Ramadan as an integral part of our Islamic lifestyle and as an invitation to the feast of the great and almighty Allah.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Southern Africa can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alami, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Russia Navy warship, and China Navy warship. This is Iranian Navy warship 235, I call you on channel 16. Do you read me? Over.
The Maritime Security Belt 2024 has officially kicked off with Russian and Chinese vessels entering Iran's territorial waters south of the country on Tuesday. The naval and airborne units of Iran's army and the IRGC, along with their Chinese and Russian counterparts, will participate in various operations during this exercise. Naval delegations from Azerbaijan, Pakistan, Kazakhstan, Oman, and South Africa have also taken part as observer states. At the first stage of the drill, the naval officers of the three countries as well as the observer states reviewed different phases of the exercise on maps and held tactical briefings. Later, the naval commanders of Iran, Russia, and China held a joint presser. The Iranian Navy's deputy commander said the main aim of the joint exercise is to help safeguard security in the northern part of the Indian Ocean.
Upholding peace and security in the north of Indian Ocean and having a specialized cooperation in combating piracy and terrorism in our region are among the main goals of this exercise. We are constantly working to improve this cooperation.
Meanwhile, Chinese and Russian Navy commanders said the joint exercise further demonstrates the preparedness of the participating countries to maintain security while also deepening their practical cooperation. 2024 is the fifth consecutive year that the Islamic Republic of Iran's Navy is hosting countries participating in the Maritime Security Belt drills in the northern Indian Ocean region.
This year's naval drills have kicked off under the motto, Together for Peace and Security, with participating countries highlighting the importance of jointly safeguarding regional security. Ahdiya Bosyan, Konarak.
This is not the first time Palestinian people are spending Ramadan under Israeli aggression.
In 2014, the Israeli regime also waged a destructive war on Gaza during the Holy Month. However, the current genocidal war is unprecedented in terms of its colossal casualties. Many Palestinians have become orphans and widows and lost their children. The memory of their loved ones will stay with them in Ramadan.
The life here is so difficult. The holy month of Ramadan is around the corner and we are still displaced from our homes and our families are torn apart. We have nothing to eat for iftar. I'm originally from Gaza. I've lost 37 members of my family. They were so close to my heart. Every time I remember them, my gut is wrenched and I become so sad and furious.
With markets destroyed and goods scarce, Gazans don't know where their iftar meals will come from, which means more suffering and agony. The vast majority of the people live in small tents amid the starvation that has already claimed the lives of several Palestinian children.
The situation in Gaza is very difficult. There is no food. The people are struggling to find anything to eat with flour scarce. Here in the south, they queue in long lines for food. Even those who attempt to get anything from the aid trucks are putting their lives at risk as Israeli soldiers open fire on them. I don't know what we're going to do in Ramadan.
Palestinians' catastrophe doesn't stop with the loss of their relatives. It is deepened by the full-scale destruction that has become palpable in every corner of Gaza, including mosques, which means they won't be able to say their prayers and worships as usual. Even if their mosques hadn't been destroyed, it would still be impossible for them to perform their prayers under the incessant Israeli bombardments.
The humanitarian conditions are completely disastrous. The people were displaced from several parts of Gaza, including the northern and central areas of the Strip. It is literally catastrophic. There is no source of income or food, and the people are completely relying on the small amounts of donation provided by limited numbers of charity institutions. In addition to that, mosques have been completely destroyed by Israeli warplanes, and we will never be able to pray in them.
While some aid has been trickling into Gaza, it's minuscule compared to the needs of the Palestinians. With Ramadan arriving, more assistance cannot come soon enough for them.
As the whole Muslim nation welcomes Ramadan, Palestinians are wondering why they have been abandoned by many Muslim leaders to face the Israeli campaign of death and starvation. To Abu Musabbih, the central area of Gaza Strip.
The Iranian National Oil and Gas Company says that this is the most strategic project in the history of Iran's oil and gas industry and its long-sought empowerment of domestic entities. Under this project, 90 trillion cubic feet of gas and 2 billion barrels of gas condensates will be available for use. Top Iranian companies Petropars, Oil Industries Engineering and Construction, Khatam al-Anbiya Construction Headquarters, Mapna Group, and a consulting company are the contractors of the mega project.
In the subject matter of the development and increase of capacities of the gas and oil refineries, we witnessed the second phase of Abadan refinery with the capacity of 210,000 barrels, which helped the production and supply of gas in the country. In the 14th phase of the South Pars refineries, 50 million cubic feet of gas is produced per day, which again adds to the capacity of gas production in the country.
The massive project has created an opportunity to kickstart economic prosperity and employment in the face of unilateral Western sanctions. This has also allowed Iranian producers and companies to engage greatly in the economic growth and industrial development of the country and neutralize the sanctions.
Today, all Iranian people should witness the fact that the surrounding nations trust the Iranian National Oil Company and the relative competent companies and contractors and do rely on them, because they know well that the South Pass was built by Iranian companies, and the day that they thought that it was impossible to do so without the help and presence of foreigners, that exact day was the day that South Pass became what it is today.
While sanctions have forced the governing bodies to change their attitude towards domestic companies and entrust them with tasks, it should be noted that Iranian producers are not perennial supporters of sanctions. Rather, they would like to interact and acquire world-class technologies from foreign companies to empower themselves.
With contracts for developing oil and gas field sites and projects for boosting pressure in South Pars gas field being started, Iran is experiencing yet another success in the mega gas project to exploit the immense gas field. Fateh Masumi, Tehran.
Chants echoed through the streets of the Pakistani capital Islamabad as thousands of demonstrators gathered to condemn the United States and Israel.
Ceasefire now!
The protest, organized by Pakistan's largest religio-political party, Jamaat-e-Islami, saw passionate crowds marching through the streets, expressing solidarity with the Palestinian cause and denouncing Israel's actions, which take place with the support of the U.S.
Of course, there should be a ceasefire long ago, but even now we are pressing for it, and you have seen how irresponsible and insensitive Biden has been responding. He was just having ice cream and talking about ceasefire as if it was a very casual affair. And on the other hand, the way children are dying, women are dying from morning till night, and especially there are a lot of prisoners which are taken by Israel. And there are large number of women and children who have been taken as prisoners, and their condition is pathetic.
The acts of solidarity in Pakistan reflect widespread outrage and sympathy for the plight of the Palestinian people.
As a Pakistani citizen, I think that our government should immediately call for a ceasefire and boycott all the products that are supporting the Israeli aggression in Palestine. And I also want to say that the whole world should come out of their houses and protest, because the kids, Palestinian kids, are starving right now, and they are being starved, and they are scared, and they are homeless, and they have nothing to eat and drink, and they are dying. And how can anybody bear that?
The protesting Pakistanis called on the government to cut its ties with the U.S. over what they call the barbaric role in the killing of innocent men, women and children in Gaza.
People here in Pakistan are concerned about the ongoing atrocities committed by Israeli forces in Gaza. They are demanding that the international community enforce an immediate ceasefire by bringing the U.S. and Israel to the International Court of Justice for their war crimes in Gaza. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
Syrians have long been accustomed to eagerly welcoming the holy month of Ramadan, brimming with joy and happiness. But this year has brought an unusual sense of sadness as the harsh economic conditions exacerbated by unjustified Western sanctions is casting a shadow over their celebrations. Moreover, their hearts are heavy with sorrow for their brethren in Gaza, who endure the devastating consequences of the ongoing Israeli onslaught.
We are going through a painful situation as people do not have money due to the poor economic conditions. As store owners, we are trying to consider the people's circumstances by reducing prices during Ramadan. However, basic production materials are expensive due to the importing difficulties.
Ramadan is always a special month, as it is a month of worship, patience and blessings, especially in Palestine. However, this year, it is as if Palestinians in Gaza have been fasting for more than 5 months. We pray for them and gain our determination, patience and steadfastness from the brave faces of Gaza's children, the resilience of its resistance fighters, and the patience of its steadfast women.
Ramadan comes this year while the Western world, which claims freedom and humanity, practices double standards with the people of Gaza, who are suffering from hunger, blockade, and Israeli crimes. Palestinians are paying the price for demanding their freedom and legitimate rights. Syrians will always stand with them until the final victory over the Zionist regime and the liberation of the occupied lands.
The month of Ramadan comes this year amid the continued unjust Western economic blockade on Syria. We see our people in Gaza suffering from blockade, hunger, killing, destruction, and continuous Zionist aggression without deterrent.
Syrians are a living nation because they have defended resistance, and the Palestinian people are the soul of resistance. We say to the West, you will lose, and the access of resistance from Iran to Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Palestine, and Yemen will prevail. We will break the Caesar Act and all your blockades on Syria and Gaza, and we will all pray in Al-Quds.
Syrian message to their brothers and sisters in Gaza is that no matter how difficult our circumstances may be, your tragedy in Gaza remains even more challenging, and your resilience is an inspiration not only for us, but for all free people around the world.
Syrians welcome Ramadan this year amid hard economic conditions due to unjust Western sanctions and with heavy hearts for their besieged brothers and sisters in Gaza. Yet their commitment to the resistance fuels their faith in eventual victory. Ibrahim Wahdi, Damascus.
Yemen is from all walks of life gathered in the capital Sana'a and other major cities and chanted slogans in praise of the Yemeni army's naval operations. They also reaffirmed their full support for the Palestinian people and pledged to continue the protests until the Israeli genocide ceases.
The Yemeni government, all its members, its president and the people have one position, which is to support the Palestinian cause. We must thwart the American, Israeli and British project and stop starvation in Palestine. Our position is an honorable position, and our broad movement indicates that the Yemenis have great awareness and, God willing, victories for the nation will be at hand.
Protesters expressed support for the Yemeni army's naval operations against Western vessels, stating that the Palestinian cause helped the Yemeni people overcome the problems created by the Western powers in the country. They believe the conspiracy targets the whole region, not just Palestine or Yemen, and call on all Muslims to unite to thwart Western projects.
We went out today in Sana'a, as you can see, and in the rest of the governorates to announce to the world that our demonstrations and our position is a religious position that will not change with regimes or rulers. We will continue to insist on our position until our brothers in Gaza are victorious, receive food and medicine, and the U.S.-Israeli genocide against them stops. Our army will also continue its operations until the aggression against our country stops. Our operations are escalating, and upcoming strikes will stun both friends and enemies.
Our demonstration here in Sana'a and other governorates is to send a message that we as Yemenis have been able to overcome all the differences and problems that the enemies sought to create inside Yemen. The other message is that we continue to support the Palestinian cause, and what is happening in Gaza is shameful for all Arabs and Muslims. The operations of our army in the Red Sea and Bab al-Mandab are completely linked to what is happening to the people of Gaza, and the escalation of naval military operations is a legitimate move to support the Palestinian cause.
Recently, the Yemeni army intensified its naval attacks against American, British and Israeli-linked vessels in regional waterways, resulting in the sinking of a British vessel in the Gulf of Aden. It also attacked an American vessel, which the U.S. claimed led to loss of lives among the ship's crew members.
Yemenis assert that the success of Yemeni naval attacks, despite the presence of Western warships in the Red Sea and Gulf of Aden, demonstrates the capability and high-tech weaponry possessed by the Yemeni army. They believe this achievement should inspire other regional forces to join the fight and support the Palestinians in face of the common enemies. Abdul Latif Roshali, Sana'a.
In recent years, Iran and Russia have significantly enhanced their cooperation in a wide range of fields. A key driving force behind the growth of bilateral relations between the two countries is forging a new geoeconomic reality in one of the world's most strategic regions. Both nations have been pursuing several objectives in this regard. They have been after establishing an independent monetary system, energy market, and parallel supply chains outside the control of Western regulatory frameworks to circumvent sanctions imposed in an attempt to isolate them. And their efforts have yielded significant success. In the field of trade, despite facing severe sanctions, Iran has managed to surpass the $2 billion threshold in exports to Russia. Iran's exports to Russia predominantly consist of fruits, polymer products, vehicles, non-metal minerals, and chemical products. Similarly, Russian exports to Iran, valued at the same amount, mainly comprise agricultural products. Iranian officials have hailed the economic cooperation between the two nations as closer than ever.
Analyzing the export trend, we see an acceptable growth in all sectors, with Iran's exports to Russia witnessing a notable increase in both volume and value. This progress not only contributes to the advancement of the two nations, but also lays the foundation for the development of other regional countries.
The total value of annual bilateral trade between the two countries reached $4.9 billion in 2023, according to Iran's official statistics. A Russian economic delegation was in Tehran in late February for the 17th round of their Joint Economic Commission. Both sides then pledged to boost trade tenfold over the coming years. Mahdi Abusyan, Tehran.
Ayahs and 30 days. In the name of God, the All Compassionate, the All Merciful, Salam and welcome to the program. A monotheist person not only reflects on the Quran, but also tries to explain the ayahs of this heavenly scripture to others and make them familiar with its teachings. Explicating the Quranic teachings, first of all, was the duty of the Prophet and his infallible successors. Every faithful too, according to the extent that they had learned from the Ahlul Bayt, embarked on this heavenly duty. So, the ulama, that is the Muslim scholars, took over this duty after the occultation of the 12th infallible successor of the Prophet, Imam Mahdi, may God hasten his reappearance, and have seriously continued this job till the present day. Today, this duty has become highly important due to the broad assault of enemies against the beliefs of Islam and humanity. In the second episode of Ramadan special series, we are going to explain Ayah 172 of Surah Baqarah of the Noble Quran. This ayah speaks about eating pure bounties and thankfulness towards Allah, the creator of all bounties. Stay tuned, please. Ramadan is an endless bounty which we are obligated to thank God for it. To be thankful of Allah for this great bounty, we should get proper recognition of it. It has been narrated from the Prophet that should the faithful know the merit and greatness of the blessed month of Ramadan, they would wish the whole year were Ramadan. Prophet Muhammad also said that Ramadan is the month in which we are invited to Allah's banquet. Let us think over this statement. Aren't we using Allah's bounties every moment? Aren't we Allah's guest throughout our life? Is it not Allah who has created the entire universe? So, the blessed month of Ramadan should be a very special period, and God has invited us to a very special banquet. According to the Prophet, we are the guests of Allah, but it is quite clear that not everybody deserves to enter the banquet to be Allah's guest. He who steps in this divine banquet tries to provide the grounds for gaining the divine bounties and gifts. Therefore, this great bounty has to be thanked greatly. The Messenger of Mercy, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, says, "Had you known what is there for you in the month of Ramadan, you would have increased thanksgiving to Allah." The Noble Quran has recommended the faithful in many ayahs to benefit from the divine bounties while emphasizing on thanksgiving to Allah. Real thanksgiving is to be a submissive servant for God. As it was said today, we are going to touch upon Ayah 172 of Surah Baqarah, which reads, "O you who have faith, eat of the good things we have provided you, and thank Allah if it is Him that you worship." Human beings should be in remembrance of God from the moment that he wakes up till night and thank God for the bounties he benefits on that day. Imam Ali, peace upon him, says in Sermon 193 of Nahjul Balagha, while describing a God-weary person, he starts his night with thanksgiving and his morning with remembrance of Allah. God has mentioned the properties of the faithful in many parts of the Quran. Forgetting of these properties will deal a fatal blow to the faithful and their society. Ingratitude and neglecting of bounties are what Satan suggests and tempts. When God expelled Satan from paradise, he saw that he would sit on the way of humans till the day of judgment and would tempt them for their front, behind, right, and left. But Allah told him that he would be given respite till a specific time, which according to some exegetes of the Noble Quran, is the day of uprising of the Savior of mankind, Imam Mahdi. May God hasten his reappearance. Now, the point to note here is that Satan swore to Allah that Allah would not fund most of human beings thankful. Ayahs 5 and 6 of Surah Ibrahim of the Noble Quran also read, "Uncertainly we sent Moses with our signs. Bring your people out from darkness into light and remind them of Allah's days. There are indeed signs in that for every patient and grateful." And when Moses said to his people, "Remember Allah's blessing upon you when he delivered you from Pharaoh's clan, who inflicted a terrible torment on you and slaughtered your sons and spared your women, and in that there was a great test from your Lord." It is noteworthy that it is only the insightful people who taste the sweetness of thanksgiving. There are those who have not caused their soul and mind to sleep. Some people enjoy bounties, but they are not satisfied and happy. As it is often said, they see only the empty half of the glass. They have a negative look at the world and events. Most of us are heedful of health only in the time of disease. When there is drought, we complain and are concerned. If we are told that we are healthy, we say, "So what? It is natural." When we have ample rainfall and snowfall in winter, we say, "So what? It is natural." Winter is the season of rain and snow. The point is to be thankful all the time, instead of saying that it is natural, we should say thank Allah. One way for thanksgiving is to enlist our bounties. Enlisting and mentioning of bounties will give us a good feeling and help us pass behind crises in life. God says in Ayah 26 of Surah Anfal, "And remember when you were few, abased in the land, and feared lest the people should despoil you.